May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Ronald Honick. Despite the passing of the statute of limitations in this case, the state was permitted to obtain convictions of Mr. Honick based on very belated and bald assertions that he allegedly engaged in misconduct 17 to 21 years earlier. However, the current statute of limitations regarding sex offenses with minors prohibited the 2009 prosecution of Mr. Honick. Here, the complainant was 29 years old in 2009 when he first came forward with these allegations. At that time, that conduct allegedly occurred was between 1988 and 1992. There was a 5-year statute of limitations in place. Since that time, that statute has been amended once and replaced once. And the history of the permutations of the statute of limitations is very helpful in this case. As I already stated, prior to 1988, in Section 205B1, statute of limitations dealing with felonies set forth a 5-year statute of limitations. During that time, that applied to Mr. Honick because that's what was in place between 1988 and 1992. And under that statute, the time for prosecution would have expired, depending on when the actual incident occurred, in 1997. He was not prosecuted in this time frame. Now, in 1992, before the expiration of Mr. Honick's, the 5-year statute of limitations, the legislature extended the statute of limitations and stated that even if the 5 years had elapsed, the state can bring forth prosecution as long as it's within 2 years of any disclosure. So it's a sort of like a late disclosure extension.
Now, did the prosecution in this case, if that provision had still existed, did it fit within that?
I think there was some dispute as to when the actual, when they would consider the first allegation having been brought forward. There was a question as to whether in an earlier investigation of something else, some issues had come up with respect to him possibly engaging in some type of sexual offenses. There was some dispute as to whether that was the actual first time there were allegations or if this 2009 was the first time. So that was never clearly answered based on the record. Our position would be that more than 2 years had elapsed, and under 1992's version, his statute of limitations would have expired. But what happened here was he was not prosecuted, and even if there were no allegations made before 1992, before 2003, excuse me, that statute was completely eliminated, and a new statute was imposed. So in 2003, the original statute of limitations plus the extension was wiped out. In 2003, Mr. Honick had not been prosecuted, and arguably there were no allegations at that particular time. Thus, the 2003 statute of limitations is what is in play in 2009 when he is eventually prosecuted. And that is what the state relies on and says that the 2003 statute says that it applies to all causes of actions arising before, on, or after July 15, 1992.
So your position is that the current statute essentially revived the ability of the state to prosecute this offense, which otherwise had been was barred by the prior statute of limitations.
That's the state's argument that it revived it. What our argument is,
rephrase it, unconstitutionally revived the prior offense.
Yes. First of all, our argument is that it wasn't intended to revive that by the legislature. And even if it were, it was unconstitutionally ex post facto. And the way we get there is two ways. The complete reading of the plain language of the statute, and it appears that the state agrees that the 2003 statute supplanted the earlier statute of limitations. So when this court addressed the 1992 statute, it addressed the language that said if subsection B which dealt with 5 years, has expired, you can still prosecute if it's within 2 years of late disclosure. And the reasoning of this court in Bryant versus State was, if the original 5 years hadn't elapsed at that time, that was not unconstitutionally ex post facto. Okay? It was after that decision that the legislature came forward with different language here and said, notwithstanding the 5 years, here's the state can bring forth prosecution anytime given certain conditions, which is part of the second issue. But the legislature knew that if it said, if that is expired, if subsection B is expired, then you can continue to do this. And yet it chose not to use that language. It chose not to extend. It could have said, for example, if the five-year statute of limitations has expired, the state can still bring a prosecution at any time. It didn't do that. That's what it did in 1992. And this court said in Bryant that that's an extension. And the legislature was aware of that. But more significantly is the legislative intent, which is very clear. The synopsis that accompanied the 2003 amendment was that this does not subject those for whom the old statute of limitations has told to additional criminal liability. So there appears on the face to be a contradiction between the language of the 2003 statute, which says this applies to all causes of actions rising before, on, or after 1992, and the legislative intent, which says if the old statute of limitations has run, then this doesn't apply to them. But it is easily reconciled, because what it appears that this legislature was trying to do here was to save any prosecutions that had already been in place. So if it was a five-year statute of limitations had elapsed and someone was being prosecuted.
By in place, what do you mean? Were actually filed?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Could be filed.
That were actually filed, were being brought at the time of this amendment, or excuse me, replacement. And the 5 years had elapsed, but yet they were being prosecuted because of the extension. What this language in the statute was designed to do was to save those prosecutions. Because if they didn't put that in there, the 2003 version would have voided out the extension and the five-year statute of limitations, and arguably there'd be problems with the state's prosecutions in those cases.
I assume we're not helped by a synopsis that explains that was their intent. I assume we're not helped by a synopsis to the what you refer to as the replacement that explains clearly that was their intent. So we're left with the language to determine what their intent really was.
Yeah, it's true that if the language is plain, then we don't go to the legislative intent, if that's what Your Honor is addressing.
Well, sometimes there's a synopsis, drafted by some person of interest in legislative hall or some person with interest in legislative hall that tries to explain why the legislature is adopting this particular bill at this mm-hmm. particular time. Sometimes it seems consistent with the language of the bill itself, sometimes not. Sometimes to the extent the bill's clear language is ambiguous, the synopsis mm-hmm. helps resolve the ambiguity. Sometimes there's no synopsis at all except to tell us what it's going to cost to implement the legislation. Mm-hmm. So is there anything to help here that's consistent with your point of view?
Well, that if you read it within, if you read it together with the plain language, it makes sense. Upon first discovering
What's it? Read it together with the plain language.
The synopsis with the plain language, it makes sense. Because if we go back to the plain language, the plain language.
So I take it the answer to my question is yes, the synopsis does help resolve
this.
Yes,
that is correct.
Okay.
I apologize. I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure I understand your constitutional position. Is it that once the statute of limitations, whatever it may be, has expired with respect to particular conduct, then any statute that purports to revive the statute of limitations. I'm sorry, eliminate the statute of limitations and undo whatever effect it might have had would be unconstitutional.
Right.
As an ex post facto or on some other basis?
Yes, it's unconstitutionally ex post facto, and that's what the United States Supreme Court said in Stogner versus California. In that case, fortunately for that gentleman, it was a lot more clear because the statute of limitations had run many, many, many years before, and the state in that case sought to eliminate the statute of limitations when it had already run. And the court said no, that can't.
And basically, you read Stogner to say you can eliminate the statute of limitations, but only prospectively.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is that I understood you to say earlier that if all the legislature was doing is extending the statute of limitations, that wouldn't create a problem. When we got into the semantic difference between extend and supplant, I'm lost.
Okay. This court in Bryant, that's the case that talks about it extending. Okay. So at the time the 92 extension was put into play, Mr. Honick's 5 years hadn't elapsed. Okay. So the language in the 92 statute said if that 5 years has
his rights hadn't vested.
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly right. I apologize, I wasn't clear, but that's correct. And in this case, when they eliminate the statute of limitations, and let's assume when they wipe out, I should say, the original statute of limitations, they're saying, look, let's forget about the 1992 extension and the 5 years. We're starting fresh here. From here forward, we're going to do no statute of limitations. Now, we also want to make sure that those cases that have already begun prosecution, that those don't get voided. So we are going to cover that also. But for the people who the 5 years had already run, then they're still safe.
And it doesn't matter whether you call characterize the statute as either extending or supplanting the statute.
Correct. Constitutionally,
you can't do it.
Right. In this particular case, it doesn't, but there may be cases
where. In any case where the statute has run.
Right. That's correct. When it's run, then it's ex post facto. And also, the legislative intent, I believe, is that it not attach here. Now, assuming that this court determines that the statute could permit, in a general sense, prosecution in this case, it must conclude that the state failed to prove beyond reasonable doubt the provisions required for the statute of limitations. And under the 2003 statute, in order for the state to pursue prosecution, it must not be based on repressed memory of the victim that was recovered through psychotherapy unless there is independent evidence of corpus delicti. Here, the state, in each of the counts of the indictment, asserted this count is not based upon the memory of the victim recovered through psychotherapy. Thus, pursuant to 205J and 232, which states that they were supposed to allege this, they were also supposed to prove it, and they didn't do that.
Does it state that the state has to allege it in the indictment, or does it state that it is in effect a defense to an indictment?
It must be in the indictment. If the court looks at 205J, it talks about this particular exception, some others, and it says, in any prosecution in which subsection E of this section is sought to be invoked to avoid the limitation period of subsection B of this section, the state must allege and prove the applicability of subsection E. So it is required to be alleged. And
so
thus,
this is a rare instance of a party having to prove a negative.
Well, it does, I guess one could say it's rare, but it does occur. And one particular instance would be a situation where, in one of the cases, the state had to prove an individual was a non-addict in order for certain sentencing for drug charges. and it wasn't for the defense to have to prove that he, let me make sure I have that, it's all backwards.
Yeah, but this isn't for sentencing enhancement. This is to bring the charge in the first instance. It's very, very unusual.
Yes.
If it's read the way you read it.
Well, but it is within, first of all, it is within the actual statute of limitations. It does not say if the defense can show otherwise, whatever, that this is a defense. And it makes sense that the burden would be on the state because only the state and the victim would be privy to how they remembered this. For defense counsel to come forward and say, allege that as a defense, that this was recovered from repressed memory, that it would be very difficult.
So now, this would only be required to be alleged when more than 5 years have elapsed since between the time of the alleged offense and the charging. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Let me. We've had trouble today with people who've run out of time by going through their
yes.
rebuttal completely, and they look at me like I've picked their pocket when I tell them they don't have any more time. So you have 4 minutes left at your rebuttal. Do you want to save it?
I will save it, yes, sir. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. The case today presents a de novo review because it's a question of statutory interpretation, the inner workings of two changes, legislative changes to Section 205 of Title 11. The state's interpretation of how the 92 and 2003 amendments work in this particular case under these specific facts differs from that of the appellant. It's the state's position that the statute of limitations never in fact ran in this particular case, so we're not dealing with an attempted revival of an otherwise told or barred prosecution. The conduct at issue, as has been stated, occurred between 1988 and 1992. There was a legislative amendment of Section 205 in July of 1992, and that affected the general five-year statute of limitations applicable to felony prosecutions. And it stated for certain enumerated sexual offenses that a prosecution could be commenced within 2 years of the initial disclosure to either the Delaware Division of Child Protective Services or to an appropriate law enforcement agency. Thus, the statute at that time, statute of limitations applicable to these sexual offenses alleged against Mr. Haneke, was time of disclosure plus 2 years. The
now,
5 year
assuming,
time.
Assuming this statute was in effect at the time of the charging of the defendant in this case, was the disclosure to either Child Protective Services or law enforcement within 2 years of the initial disclosure?
Yes, the disclosure occurred in 2009. Now, there was an investigation that I think has been mentioned in 2004 when Mr. Haneke was being investigated for a different alleged conduct. It was possession, I believe, of child pornography, and some other witnesses who were interviewed, not the complaining witness in this case, stated that they suspected that Mr. Haneke might have abused some of his children. But the state's position is that that was not a disclosure by the complaining witness.
Mr. Williams, you told us that the first statutory amendment was in July of 92.
Correct.
And the last conduct was also in 92, that is the last of the series of alleged events. When in 92 was that?
When was the last conduct?
Mm.
I don't know exactly. The complaining witness said that these incidents happened between the time when he was 8 years of age up to age 12 or 13, and that would coincide with the 1988 to 1992 period. After he turns 12, I think after he turns 13, he no longer is staying at his father's home on the weekends.
Well, my point is this. If the five-year statute ran, I guess it couldn't have run if the last of these events was in 92, except as to the earlier events? Or are all of these events taken as a whole, that is, treated as though they've taken place in 92?
No, I think they occurred over a period of time between 1988 and 1992. But in 1992, even the earliest event in 88 would not have been barred by the five-year statute of limitations. So that's why the state's position is that the statute limitations has never run in this particular case. It's not a Stogner-type problem where the United States Supreme Court had to deal with a California statute that purported to revive what would clearly be told or barred prosecutions under the California applicable statute of limitations. States are free to extend or even eliminate statutes of limitations. At early English common law, there were no statute of limitations for criminal prosecutions. And the statute of limitations term that is decided is purely a matter of the legislature's determination. The trend has been in these child sexual assault or abuse cases to eliminate or at least substantially extend statute of limitations.
Do I understand correctly that the state is relying on the 92 amendment and that the 03 amendment doesn't really have any factual relevance?
I
thought what you were arguing was, number one, when the 92 statute, although there was a five-year statute at the time of the conduct, that had not yet expired when the statute was amended to tack on, so to speak, in some indefinite period, provided that that period ended 2 years from the time of disclosure, whenever that was.
Correct.
Is that sufficient without reference to the 03? Is that right, the 03 amendment?
Yes, the 03 is the second one.
To establish the state's case?
Well, I think it probably is, although I suspect when the disclosure occurs in 2009, the operative statute would be whatever the statute of limitations is at that time, and there was no statute of limitations after 2003. This particular case, given the facts that we don't have a toll prosecution, I don't know that it matters whether it's the 92 or 2003 statute of limitations that's applied here under either one. This would not be a toll prosecution. As I've indicated, the trend has been to either eliminate or substantially extend statute of limitations.
If the state is relying on the 92 amendment, then I gather it would follow that your position has to be the statute had not run either at the time of the disclosure or at the time of the actual prosecution. Do I have that right?
Well, I think if you rely on the 92, it's disclosure plus 2 years.
Yeah.
After 2003, you can prosecute at any time at that point. And as long as the disclosure occurs after 2003, there isn't a statute of limitations, and that's what occurred in this case.
Okay.
And I know it's confusing because there's legislative changes, but given the particular facts here that we're not dealing with an attempted revival of a toll prosecution, I don't know that ultimately it makes any difference, but I think the applicable statute of limitations is the 2003. It's a statute that's in effect when the disclosure is made and then when the prosecution proceeds. And as of 2009, there was no statute of limitations for these particular offenses here. While Stogner does hold that there can be ex post facto violations in particular instances, those only apply to prosecutions that are otherwise told. You cannot constitutionally, under the federal ex post facto clause, revive what would otherwise be a null and void prosecution. If the statute is run, you can't prosecute them, then you can't. Then in the future, change the statute of limitations to revive that prosecution. Those are not the facts in this particular case, so I don't think there's any ex post facto violation under the federal constitutional law here. The question about the synopsis, I'm not too sure what to make of the synopsis. I mean, I think the meaning of the statute is plain. Reply brief does quote it at page 2, and it just says that this is at least the intent of the drafters. It says the second paragraph, this act eliminates the statute of limitations altogether and provides that such prosecutions may be commenced at any time. So I think that's the situation we were in 2009. And the second sentence says, although this act does not subject those for whom the old statute of limitations has told to additional criminal liability, it is intended to ensure that in the future sexual offenses may be prosecuted regardless of when the crime was discovered or reported. And that's the intent, I think, of the law now. And that's what happened in this particular case.
Another way of doing that would have been, instead of saying reported within 2 years, it could have said reported within 100 years.
Well, at any time, yes. It no longer matters. There's no longer a triggering provision for the date of report under the 92 amendment. That was crucial because once the report was made, you had a two-year window to commence the prosecution. So it was time of report plus 2 years was the 92 statute of limitations for these particular offenses.
So from the ex post facto constitutional perspective, your point is doesn't apply because the five-year statute had never expired at the time of the 92 amendment. 92 amendment moved the statute up to disclosure, whenever that was, plus 2 years. And if the 2003 statute, if assuming that it had the effect of eliminating the 92 amendment, would have made the disclosure, would have made the prosecution open-ended anyway.
Yes,
but
that's
since
correct.
There was never, since under no statute of limitations had the period of limitations expired, no ex post facto. Therefore, the only issue is one of the statutory construction issue, or at least the application issue that Ms. Walker's raised. That is the repressed memory, whether that was refreshed by psychotherapy. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
That
yes,
is
I
that
think
all that's before us is that construction issue, which is not a constitutional issue.
Yes, I think that's correct, and certainly more cogently than I expressed it, but I think that's how it all works out. Given the particular facts here, that we never had a told or barred prosecution. The second issue that's been raised on appeal is whether or not Section 205J, there was a requirement to prove anything beyond the statutory elements. Originally, there were three charges. The state, I believe, ended up nulli processing at trial the incest allegation. And what went to the jury was one count of unlawful sexual intercourse, first degree, and then 11 counts of unlawful sexual contact, second degree. The jury found the accused not guilty of the USI first degree charge, but found him guilty of a lesser included offense, a 12th count of unlawful sexual contact, second, and did return a guilty verdict on the other 11 allegations of unlawful sexual contact, second.
Mr. Williams, putting aside who had the burden of proving that the prosecution wasn't the product of a repressed memory that had been refreshed by psychotherapy, what does the record indicate is the fact? That is, what was proved in that regard?
Well, I don't think there
whoever.
I'm sorry. I don't think there was actually any testimony about there being a repressed memory. And as far as I know, it was a disclosure made to law enforcement officials. And I don't think there was any indication that the complaining witness was under psychotherapy or had any repressed memory. He simply just didn't reveal it until 2009.
So the record is blank on that.
Well, I don't think the record states it one way or the other. I don't think there's a specific question.
One thing, unless my notes and memos are incorrect, it says, on direct examination, the prosecutor asked the complaining witness, why did you come forward at this point? And his answer was, I was trying to protect somebody else from having it happen to them. And he made no mention of, Well, I've been going to psychotherapy, and I'm told that it's a product of repressed memory. In other words, he has an explanation for why he came forward, and it doesn't include any mention of psychotherapy.
Yes, I think that's exactly what he said.
Now, that's the record. If there is a question, it is whether or not that carries the prosecution's burden of both pleading and establishing to the satisfaction of a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that this is not a suppressed memory, which was brought out by psychotherapy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's what he said at trial. He doesn't mention psychotherapy or that, you know, this was something that I suddenly recalled when I was talking with a counselor, that he said his motivation was he didn't want it to happen to anyone else. And I think there's a difference between a repressed memory, as I understand it. It's a psychological term or condition or something where you simply don't recall an incident, but somehow through psychoanalysis or hypnosis or some manner, you're able to then later recall it. But there's no indication that that was ever the case here, no indication that the complaining witness did not recall or remember any of this. He simply didn't disclose it until 2009, and that's different than a repressed memory recovered.
I think if there is an issue, it is this satisfactory? Has the state done all it could or should do to satisfy the statutory requirement that they established that this late memory is not a repressed memory that was disclosed during psychotherapy? Is this sufficient?
Yes, I think that's the issue, and the state's position is that unless you have that circumstance, then you don't have to go the additional steps beyond this initial inquiry, and the additional steps require, and it's kind of a warning to prosecutors, really, that, okay, if you have a repressed memory situation where it's been recovered through psychotherapy, you then have to present independent evidence of the corpus delicti, and that's where the additional evidentiary proof requirements come in. But if you don't have the initial
In terms of those proof requirements, is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
It probably would be, because I suspect it seems like it's almost an element of the offense, so I suspect you probably do have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mr. Williams, doesn't that point at least support the argument that the burden of proving that the prosecution wasn't the product of a repressed memory triggered or refreshed by psychotherapy, the state's burden?
No, I don't think you have to prove.
Because if that burden isn't met, then the state, in its case in chief, would have to have independent evidence of corpus delicti. Under the theory that, if we were to adopt the argument that is a matter of defense, then the only time the state could introduce proof of independent evidence of corpus delicti would be in its rebuttal after the case in chief has been made.
Well, I think it's only a defense if you have the unique circumstance of a repressed memory recovered through psychotherapy, that it's not an element, statutory element of the crime, so the state is not required to prove the negative. It is unusual for the state to have to prove a negative. That was the argument that was made in Lively about the possession of the deadly weapon by a person prohibited.
Mr. Williams, how can we conclude that it's not an element of the crime if subsection J expressly states the state must allege and prove the applicability of subsection, I guess in this case it would be E, as an element of the offense?
Well, and then if you look at E, it also says no prosecution under the subsection shall be based upon the memory of the victim that has been recovered through psychotherapy unless there is some evidence of the corpus delicti independent of such repressed memory. So unless you get into that second sentence of subsection E of 205, you don't worry about the state having any burden of proving that or proving the negative of that.
Why isn't the burden satisfied by asking the complaining witness, why did you come forward at this point? And he says, not that I was going to psychotherapy, and I learned that my repressed memory revealed that this incident had taken place X years ago. He says, I was trying to protect somebody else from having it happen to them. Unless there's some Brady allegation that the state had information to the contrary and didn't bring it forward or didn't disclose it to the defense, why doesn't that establish the element?
Oh, I think it does. I think, you know, the inquiry can end there. And then it's just a question of, well, should they have asked yet another question about, well, now you didn't go talk to a psychologist and you didn't repress your memory about any of this.
Or cross-examine your own witnesses. Are you sure that it wasn't a psychotherapist that allowed you to discover by your repressed memory that you had been assaulted X number of years ago? I mean, why would you ask that question?
Oh, I don't think you would, and I don't think you're required to under the statutory provisions that are operative here, given all the facts here. I think the inquiry that was made, the basis for the disclosure as related at trial by the complaining witness was sufficient, and I think the statute is...
Rule 16 discovery, would that ordinarily include information about whether the complaining witness in these kinds of cases had been to a psychotherapist and that the report of the psychotherapist was in the Attorney General's file? Wouldn't that be disclosed?
I would think you would have to, because of the way the statute's written now, that if you do have a repressed memory and psychotherapy recovers it, I think you do have to disclose that. I think that would, you know, certainly be part of the investigation that has to be disclosed to the defendant, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
I'm going to attempt to answer Chief Justice Steele's question. The answer as to why someone comes forward is not an answer as to how they remembered it. When I say, why did you come forward? Well, to help somebody else. Okay. Does that mean he remembered it for any number of reasons? This gentleman, when he was 13 years old, was interviewed by social services and disclosed that he was beaten by his father, but when asked, he did not disclose that he had been sexually abused. When he was a full-grown adult, he moved in with his father and his 3 or 4-year-old son and entrusted him with the care of his son.
All right, well, let me make sure I understand, as a practical matter, where we're going with this. Is it your position that this entire prosecution is defective because the prosecutor didn't ask a second question, which is, have you been under the treatment of a psychotherapist, and was the information about the incident of which you complain discovered only by means of psychotherapy?
Absolutely. That is what the statute says. As Justice Ridgely pointed out, they had to allege it and they had to prove it. Now, let's assume for a moment that otherwise, why would they put it in the indictment? They put it in the indictment. Once it's in the indictment, they have a duty to prove it.
I don't disagree with that. If the statute says it's an element of the offense, and the burden is clearly placed on the state to both allege it and prove it, I don't think there's an argument that's serious that they don't have to, they don't at least have the burden of going forward and the burden of persuasion. The question is, what more do they have to do in the absence of any facts to show that it's not the product of a repressed memory that's discovered by means of psychotherapy?
Well, the absence of facts actually cuts in favor of the defendant. There needs to be facts one way or the other. They would ask him, how is it that you recall that this happened? He answers XYZ. I've remembered this since I was 12 years old.
So your position is that they had to ask that second question or this entire prosecution is faulty, even though there's no evidence that he ever went to psychotherapy or that any of these memories were triggered by treatment.
That's correct. They had a duty to show that it was not the result of psychotherapy. What Your Honor is in the contrary position, as Your Honor seems to be tending toward, although I could be wrong.
I'm just trying to make your day. That's all.
And I appreciate that. But what I think is that would be correct, that they wouldn't have to ask that question if it was an affirmative defense. Let's assume there we have some case where the state puts in, you know, we're alleging an assault, and they put in there, which might already be built into it, and it wasn't done in self-defense. The state has to prove that it wasn't done in self-defense if they put that in their indictment. That's what they did here.
Where do we go with this? Let's assume that there's no memory that's been recovered through psychotherapy, but someone's been to psychotherapy. I guess if the statute has to be proven, then you're entitled to discovery of all of the psychotherapeutic records and everything else just to check the veracity of the statement, or at least an in-camera inspection?
I haven't thought all that through, but I think that that would probably be where this would go, and that's the wording that the legislature used. It's understandable why they put it in there, but it does create problems for the state.
Well, another practical problem would be if you had the question and answer that took place at this trial, and then you, Ms. Walker, get up and say, well, when did you recall this? Well, I recalled it after I went to psychotherapy, in which case you've got, you know, a factual issue. What is the judge supposed to do then?
Correct. And the defense has put in evidence, has opened up the door to put in evidence for the state. And if I may make one more statement, my time is up.
If it's in response to Justice Jacobs' question,
yes. Once they put it in the indictment, they had to prove it, even if the court were to find that otherwise, generally speaking, they wouldn't have to. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.